Hi, everyone. I'm Michael Concannon of the FinTech and Payments Association of Ireland. And on behalf of the FPAI and our member firm FSCOM and partner organisation, the European Women in Payments Network, we're absolutely delighted to welcome you here to this evening's event. I just want to say how happy that we are to be associated with the European Women in Payments Network and today's event, especially as the subject and the broader subject of diversity and inclusion are very important to us and they're part of our objectives, and we welcome opportunities to be able to work with organisations like you guys. On an entirely personal level, and as a man, I have to say that today's subject is a matter that I find difficult, because I feel, as a man, sort of a mixture of shame and frustration and difficulty in knowing how to react and what to say beyond horror and shock. So I'm particularly interested in hearing your story, Sarah, and and be informed but also inspired as to what we can and should be doing. And hopefully I'm speaking for everybody, and especially some of the men maybe here. By the way, I'm still getting loads of people coming up to me and telling me how happy they are to come to physical events, or as one wag described it to me there recently as, it's great to be at a three-dimensional event. So we would be delighted if you could all hang back afterwards and join us all for the chat and a bit of networking and a glass of wine or two, which we aim to do at around 6:30-ish or thereabouts. So without further ado, I will hand over to Alison, who will do some introductions and get the discussion going. Thank you very much, Alison.
Thank you as well, everybody, for coming. Michael and I didn't share notes or discuss what he was going to say, and it's absolutely perfect, because I was going to start with saying that I am, Louise kindly introduced you to us, and when I and the others who are organising the events heard about your story, oh yes, definitely want to interview you, that sounds perfect. And then we began really thinking about it, and then we all went, it's a bit awkward, isn't it? It's a bit, goodness, how will it be received? Will people want to come and hear? And you know, how would I even ask questions and pose questions? So first of all, it's brilliant that you acknowledge that, and that's exactly how I wanted to start this. And Sarah, you've been brilliant, because you have at these with asking questions, and so we have agreed that even if I stumble over how I put things across and if I use language incorrectly, you're not going to be offended. Doing it, if I'm making it a mistake, it's out of ignorance and it's not out of malice, and so to everybody in the room, please do feel free to ask the question that's on your mind, whether that's hopefully you'll be able to ask in this forum, but Beth, I'm sure Sarah would mind if you sneak up at the end and ask directly. So please, everybody feel relaxed to do that. So, Sarah, can you start off by telling us your story?
Yep, and I'll, I assume everyone here has read the description, or won't. But so I am the survivor of a very violent sexual assault that happened about 3 years ago, and I won't go into like graphic detail about it because I can literally say buy my book. also like, you know, conscious of not triggering people, and like to acknowledge your point, Michael, it is something that's like difficult to talk about. But in a nutshell, about 3 years ago, on a Tuesday night at 3 a.m. I was fast asleep in my bed. Burglar broke into our apartment through my bedroom window, stole everything of value, went back out to stash the loot, and then came back in with the sole intention of doing what he did. I didn't wake up at the beginning and woke up with him on top of me strangling me, and cue a very violent fight in which I nearly died, and you know, injuries and so on, but escaped with my life, but you know, survived a kind of very harrowing sexual assault. And so after that, about 2 years of, you know, grappling with the Irish criminal justice system and kind of realizing as a lawyer how many obstacles are in the path of victims or survivors, and you know, once we secured the conviction, made the decision to go public about it, which, for, you know, reasons we'll go into, but the main one being wanted to shed a light on this because I, like, as a lawyer, didn't know about this and was just horrified at how terrible our system treats survivors. But also really wanted to raise awareness with, like, you, the people, and, you know, like, society more generally, as to how to talk about difficult topics and how to talk about trauma and how to talk about sexual assault and how to react to people and kind of normalize this topic. Because you, like, you know, you look at, like, the WHO statistics, and it's, they say, you know, 1 in 3 women, and I think it's 1 in 6 men or something, have survived, like, a violent or sexual violence. That number is probably higher because we don't talk about it. And, you know, I've had lots of people come to me saying, oh, I went through something similar, but it wasn't as bad as yours. And I'm like, you can't compare, like, sexual trauma. Trauma is trauma, actually. So kind of decided to go public through the Irish Times, and then an offer came to write the book, Ash and Salt, which I did. And that seems to have gotten a really good reception, as in you're all here. So thank you for coming. So yeah, that's the story.
Thank you, Sarah. And again, just to reiterate it, I mean, it is amazing that you're able to come and tell the story, and able because you survived, which involved a huge fight, both in that room and then subsequently. You mentioned the book, Ashes and Salt.
Yeah.
And Salt. That's a metaphor you use in the book, and it's not quite how I was thinking it would be.
Yeah, it surprises a few people, actually. So, like, surprisingly, Ash and Salt is about healing. So, as you said, I talk a lot in metaphors or images in the book. So Ash is kind of the self-explanatory side of things. You know, I talk about, like, the impact of rape or sexual assault, and I kind of describe it as, you know, it's like a volcano that just blasts a hole through every dimension of your life, like your sense of identity, your sense of safety, you know, your how you perceive yourself as a woman, like your relationships with friends and family and so on. So it's that, it just feels like everything's been reduced to ash. And it's certainly, that's how I felt afterwards. I know a lot of survivors have told me the same. You feel like there's nothing left to live for. And I think one of the reasons we're so uncomfortable talking about it is because it is sort of a death sentence. So ash is that symbol of, you know, death and finality. But then I go on to say, volcanic ash is actually one of the most fertile types of soil in the world, and it can be a place of renewal, and you can, you know, get new shoots that really flourish and blossom. And I kind of point to, that's your life after the assault if you put the work in. But then you have salt, and so salt, as we know, is, you know, salt in the land is poison, salt is toxic, it corrodes materials. And I use the it's the legend where the Romans sacked and burned the city of Carthage to the ground. And they were so adamant that nothing would grow from there ever again, that they sowed salt over the ashes to make sure nothing can grow of that. So I use salt in the book as a kind of an image to talk about things that hinder your healing. And they're like very toxic things, like toxic thoughts, behaviors, patterns, environments, people, friends, you know. And I kind of, the book is very much designed as a survival guide. So every chapter has a different theme. And it's like, how do you steer clear of the salt or limit your exposure to salt as much as possible and ensure that, you know, new life can grow from the ashes. So that's the, yeah, that's the kind of the summary of the book.
Brilliant. And to that point about the coping strategies,
yeah,
the thing that you have had to do and learn to do to help yourself, I had those change from the initial days and weeks,
yeah,
through to now where you are 3 years later.
Yeah.
And what are those?
They changed hugely, actually. So I kind of track them all in the book, and I've got, it's slightly chronological as well. So I talk about, you know, the immediate aftermath, and that's the, we're back to the ashes. And I kind of talk about it like the Shadowland. And you're just coming to terms, or I was coming to terms with, my life is over. Like, you know, I'm ashamed of what's happened to me. This is an irreparable mark. I can never not be a rape survivor ever again. That's just it. It's going to impact, you know, my dating life, my relationship with family, friends, you know, my career and so on. So you're grappling with that. You're also grappling with the immediate effects of PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. So it really varies depending on each survivor. Like, everybody's so different. We respond to trauma very differently. For me, it was like I couldn't be touched, not even by my parents, not even a handshake. very difficult when you're a corporate lawyer and you're in a room full of people and they want to shake your hand and you're like having a panic attack. So in the immediate aftermath, it was a lot of trial and error, I won't lie. Like, there are a lot of stuff that didn't work and you're just trying to get through it day by day, hour by hour. Just, it's a survival mechanism. But I was, well, I still am like a certified yoga teacher, so I kind of got into yoga and that helped me reconnect with my body a little bit. I was getting a lot of dissociation, which is you just don't feel connected to yourself at all. So like a very striking memory I still think about from time to time is, you know, I'd look at passing traffic on the road and your brain just thinks I could jump into that and nothing would happen. Like, that's dissociation. You just feel like nothing's real, like it's a video game or something. So yoga helps me get back into like feel your hands against the mat, feel like your feet. And it was very basic. Like, it wasn't, you know, headstands or anything like that. It was hands on the mat, knees on the mat. Let's just like feel the fingers, feel the hands. As I kind of progressed through, yoga definitely like stayed in the picture. There was a lot of tools that I developed again through trial and error, and they don't work for everybody, but for me, therapy was a huge part of it. And for two reasons: one, normalize what I had been through. So it was one of the only places where I wasn't met with the reaction of recoiling at the term sexual assault. And also being able to put words, I found that very empowering, like putting words on what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that like the example of like watching passing traffic, I didn't know that was called dissociation. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
So then when you kind of realize, oh, this is like a documented thing that people can get out of, and there are techniques and there are tools and there are things. Now, you know, it's not a magic solution and it doesn't work overnight, but there are things you can do. And if you find a good therapist, they'll work with you. So the therapy I went to was the DRCC, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and they were just phenomenal, like just phenomenal. But, you know, you get for different types of trauma, like, I don't know, grief or whatever, you get different experts. And I find it's such an empowering tool to put words on things. And yeah, back to your point, Michael, like, it's if we're afraid of talking about things, you're never going to heal because you can't talk about the wound. And so there's no way of clearing it.
Interesting. You do talk a lot in the book about trauma,
yeah,
and being a trauma survivor. And that's one of the things that I really related to, because my daughter's adopted. I adopted her. And so without going into her story, the fact that she's adopted, you can just assume, please do, that she's a trauma survivor. And so you were describing how your panic rises up within you, and you know, the reactions, they're just so automatic, there's no time to stop and think about them. And I very definitely see that with her.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of things that came out of that for me. One was your very wise advice that you know, in dealing with helping people, being with people who have a trauma response when they're being triggered, that telling them to say, calm down and take a deep breath
really works.
Really, certainly know that's my cause. But I was interested in it just because I think it's so true. There's you know, people will have experienced trauma in their own lives and be with people who have experienced trauma, and the just knowing how to engage and help and not hinder their response is so important. And so it'd be lovely to hear more about how you experienced other people around you, and then to how you would, instead of me telling you to calm down, what would you want?
Yeah, that's such an interesting comparison. And I'll start by saying every survivor is different, right? And whether it's sexual trauma or other types of trauma, trauma is trauma, and trauma causes four different types of reaction in the human brain. And they're all equally designed to protect you. So we all know fight or flight. There's actually two more, which are freeze and fawn. And a lot of people would come to me and say, I would have frozen, you know, I would have not known what to do. And some survivors did come to me and say, I actually, you know, not only froze, but then complied with my rapist to, you know, avoid more injuries. That's all. I think the first part of people helping a trauma survivor is knowing those four responses and really being there to like help the person not feel shame, and just remind them, like, look, whatever you did, if you fought, if you ran, if you froze, if you fawn is like the one that's least known, you kind of are basically complying with your aggressor to avoid being more hurt. They are all like your brain decides in nanoseconds which of these four options has the highest likelihood of getting you out alive, and your brain will go with that. So if a train's coming at you, not much point in fawning, but you know, your brain might say freeze because maybe you like don't move and you know you think it's coming at you, but it's coming somewhere else. But every situation is different. So I think the first thing to for you, if you know you're trying to help a survivor, is to know that. And I think the second is really just being willing to be vulnerable, because, and I know it's uncomfortable, but it's like, I can guarantee the trauma survivor is probably 100 times more uncomfortable and vulnerable. And so if you're willing to just be present in a room and meet their eyes and, you know, listen to them and not, you know, think you have to say something that you've heard before, just listen. It sounds so stupid, but that literally is like what I found most helpful. And so I'd get a lot of reactions to my trauma, which were, you know, particularly women actually, which was interesting because I would have thought it would have been the other way around, but it was actually a lot of women would like avoid my gaze. And that was just such a shot to the heart because I was like, I just felt like an untouchable. And you're like, you already feel like an untouchable. And then this happens and you feel so isolated, whereas all you want is somebody to be able to sit next to you in a room, make eye contact. It's fine, whatever you need, you're having a panic attack, what do you, like, engage with the person. So, like, not the most, like, specific advice, but it is a lot of communication as well, I think. So I need certain things when I go into my trauma responses, which another survivor would hate. So, like, I just do not like being touched when I'm having a panic attack. I'm like, do not touch me because you will lose that arm. But some people need to, their hand to be held or, you know, need a hand on the shoulder. So I think you also have to be pretty kind to yourselves of, like, you are going to get it wrong and that's okay. And then you can talk about it afterwards, you know, and do a postmortem and be like, what went well? What did not? And just normalize the conversation. And, you know, sometimes it'll be different, but you're like, look, I'm just trying to understand here. And, you know, like kind of as you said, like I'm very comfortable with terms or words. Some people aren't. So I'd always use the term survivor. Sometimes I forget and I say victim and a survivor will get very angry, yeah. Rightly so. But, you know, you're just, if your intentions are good and you're trying to communicate that you're trying to help, you can't really go wrong. But you have to do it in a authentic way. So, you know, I've had a lot of people come up to me in work being like, anything I can do, and you know, and you're like, yeah, I mean, if I, you know, if I call you, you're not going to pick up the phone. So, which is, you know, like people are doing their best. We haven't been given the tools to do this. Like I talk a lot in the book about, like, we're taught questionable skills in school, like, you know, playing the tin whistle or whatever. And you're like, why did you not teach me to do my taxes, to help people in a traumatic response? Like the basics, first aid, I don't know. So it is just recognizing I know nothing, but I want to help. So teach me, what do I need to know? And I think that's the only advice I can give, really.
Do you have a big chapter in the book about anger?
It needed its own chapter. As I say, like the book is done by kind of themes. At the beginning, it's, you know, like chapter one is the attack. Chapter two is the hospital appointment. Chapter three is dealing with the police, and it's giving you survival guides at the end. So I got like a little checklist of like things to know or do that I wish I'd known at the time. But I had to put in a whole chapter on anger because it was one I didn't know how to deal with. Like I'd consider myself quite a calm, happy person. Like I was a yoga teacher, and so, you know, when this happened to me initially, I was fine, or I kidded myself I was fine, and I was like, I'm a yoga teacher, I never get angry. Absolute fool. I like anger builds up in me, and I think I use anger, but it's any emotion really. Like it could be depression, it could be anxiety, it could be shame, what, all those like negative emotions that build up in you. And again, particularly in Ireland, I think we haven't really been taught how to talk about emotion and how to identify them and how to deal with them. So I was given a lot of those tools in therapy of like, you know, like I have had depression in the past before, so I know how to deal with depression when it comes. It's very passive. I can deal with it. Anger, I just wanted to like sprint a marathon and like punch somebody at the like end. Like I just didn't know how to like sit with that emotion. And so through therapy, I kind of found out how to do that and was given the tools to do that. But I, you know, that chapter resonated a lot with people who went through anxiety or shame or whatever. And I think it's, again, like being able to identify the emotion is the hardest thing. Second hardest thing is then like dealing with it. And it's, I think, both internal and external outlets that you need. So to me, internal is like meditating or therapy or talking, the passive outlets. For my anger, I also needed a lot of exercise because I was just, it's all this energy that just makes you angry. And if you don't use that energy, it just boils up and then you slam doors and, you know, snap at people or,
you know. I've read in my adoption kind of reading that if you experience a triggering event or something that causes you anxious or, and then you're able to calm down, the chemicals are still in your body and actually you do still need to release them somewhere along the line.
Totally. And I think I had in the book, like, there's a couple of I did some limited research, so I do have a couple of surveys in there, but like, anger has been, you know, scientifically and medically proven to build up in the body. So, you know, people who are angry people are more prone to high blood pressure, heart attacks, like, you know, these are very real things. They're more prone to breathing problems because when you're angry or when you're stressed, you know, the body constricts, you're not breathing in as deeply. So, like, again, yoga is also like breathing exercises. And it was really interesting to me where, you know, I'd get angry and my therapist would be like, take a deep breath. And I was like, yeah. She's like, no, Sarah, deep breath with the stomach. And I was like, oh, I can't, like, it's blocked. And it does lead to disease over time. So, and like all emotions do, like, emotions are, I'm getting a bit like, you know, airy fairy yoga-esque, but like, bear with me. You know, in yoga, they talk about the concept of flow. So things are meant to be constantly moving and evolving and changing. And that's a good thing. The problem is when things stagnate. So there's no such thing as a negative emotion. Like, anger is perfectly healthy. Sadness, you know, deep sadness, anxiety are perfectly healthy if they move through the body. The problem is when they stagnate and stay in the body for over long periods of time, and they do build up and they turn into physical ailments. And, you know, there's suggestions that they can turn into cancer and stuff. There's not enough research there, but I wouldn't be surprised, and I'd be quite a cynical person, but there certainly is like very strong repercussions to you not dealing with your grief or your emotions or whatever it is.
When you talked about the emotions and the feelings and the anxiety around you did have some people, really good people around you. You have your sister and your mom and dad. Very highly of sister. She's got a lovely name. It's Alison.
Alison.
Great people are called Alison. Not want to make this all right, but one of the things I find living with my daughter and feeling her emotions is sometimes I can cope very well with them. I'm a good mommy, and sometimes I'm a terrible mommy because it just triggers something in me. And there is a thing now, I know, called secondary post-traumatic stress disorder. So I was wondering how your sister and your mommy and
It's a great question. And I'm really glad you're bringing this up, because you shouldn't, you know, be saying like, oh, I don't want to make this about me. Like, the whole point of these events, like, connecting as human. You know, we're not just about like work and everything. And like, everybody's, like, I'd say most people in this room have encountered trauma or lost a loved one, or, you know, had a difficult situation, like, or know somebody who have and probably have had secondary trauma of some form. So like, Alison and my mom so basically I didn't tell my family for a year about the sexual assault. They knew about the assault, and I gave them what I call the vanilla version. For a number of reasons, like, I was afraid of how, you know, I didn't want to worry them. I didn't know how I was feeling about it, blah, blah, blah. So I think for a while, they didn't really understand why I was so, like, you know, obviously they were like, you survived an attempted murder, like, you were just strangled twice, like, you nearly died, but, you know, you inflicted some damage and you got out. So, you know, like, not what's the problem, but like, you're right. Put under the carpet. But I think they were surprised when I'd get the reactions to touching. And like, I'm half French, so my mom's side are so tactile and affectionate, so that was like a problem to not be able to tell them. But yeah, basically when I told them, there was a period of denial, I think, and not like, you know, like they believed me, but I think they were so shocked and it just didn't register for a while. And I think one day it computed and then the trials started coming. And to be honest, I talk about this a lot in the book, and I still feel very strongly about these words. Like, I think the trial and the whole trial process was infinitely more traumatic than the attack. I'd go through that attack again 10 times before facing that court again. Like, and like, that's a lawyer walking in who knows, you know, how to address a judge and who knows what's happening and who had support there. Like, the court system in this country and, you know, in France as well is laughable, and we'll get into it. But so I think Alison was there with me in the trial. And I think that's where she had her first, you know, experience of secondhand trauma, or what was it called? Secondary PTSD. And it didn't come out initially. So I was, you know, she was there to support me. I was conscious of her, you know, being okay, but that ended at, you know, just don't let her, like, she won't come into the courtroom. She's just there with me. She doesn't need to hear about all the graphic details and like the joke of, like, you know, people literally dissecting your genitals and being like, how deep did it go and blah, like all that. I don't need her to hear all of that. But her, like, secondary PTSD came out when the book came out, or when the drafts were coming out and she was reading them, and she'd have such strong reactions. And I was like, I know that. That's PTSD. And
just
it hadn't.
Take a deep breath.
Yeah, take a deep breath. Don't
worry about it.
Yeah, I think, like, and my parents kind of, I think, obviously, they're all fine now. They weren't able to come to the trial because of COVID. So it was like literally me and Alison against the world. And she took everything on her shoulders, and I think didn't acknowledge that she'd been through a traumatic experience, because that trial, like, believe you me, was the stuff of nightmares. But she's fine now, but it certainly took a while. And, you know, I had to rewrite certain chapters a couple of times, because, you know, particularly the one about, like, other people, because it just hadn't hit me how much it hit her. And, you know, at that time, I was, like, I was the one who was the most in control. And you feel so out of control because it's all out of your hands. But you're like, I'm the one who has to go into the room and tell the story.
Yes.
And be believed. So you kind of think, well, Alison has to do nothing bar be there and be supportive. But actually, that's sometimes worse. And, you know, they say sometimes, like, witnesses of an accident or, you know, whatever can have worse trauma because they weren't able to do anything. And there's a fantastic book by Dr. Van de Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score, which is a long, heavy read, but I highly recommend, because it talks about how trauma lives in the body and how your brain deals with it. And so in my situation, basically, if you're able to get yourself out of a traumatic event by fighting, fleeing, freezing or fawning, some trigger, like chemical triggers, happen in the brain. I'm no scientist, but that basically tell you the alarm is gone, like, power down the alarm, we're safe. But in cases like Alison, or he compares, he uses the example of, like, soldiers in the war who were just constantly, like, exposed to, you know, bombs and blastings, and it kind of never ends. Mm-hmm. And they don't end it. It's like somebody else ends it for them. The alarms never go off. And so that's worse than if you run off and you get this sudden release of, like, that's it, we're safe, we're okay, like, go into shock.
Chemicals have to go somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, no, it was like eye-opening for me and very humbling as well to be like, you're not the only person in the room. but it's really important, and that's why I'm so grateful to, you know, people like you who come here and who are willing to listen to this and try to understand and try to apply that to your lives, because it's gonna, you know, you're gonna have some form of this. It may not be, you know, a sexual assault or whatever, but there's a lot of trauma survivors out there.
Let's talk about the trial. One of the things that impressed me, I will take away, was that you took copious notes. You wrote everything down. I'm not a particularly journal type person, but really interesting. But that was one of the things that was real.
Yeah. So I think, like, the trial is, even for, like, somebody who practices law, I had no idea what was happening. There's no visibility. Nobody talks to you. Nobody, like, they just treat you like you're not there. And there's, you know, everybody you deal with on an individual basis is very nice, but the system is just so fucked. Like, there's no other word for it. It's just a disaster. And so the only form of control I had was recording everything down. And I was like, this is going to come in useful at some point. Like, it'll be, you know, if there's an appeal, I'll have caught something, or, you know, they mentioned something, somebody did this wrong, maybe that can be used, maybe we'll have a contemporaneous note of something, you know, like spot the lawyer a mile away. That was the only form of like control I had. And so, you know, I was given a like special dispensation to not be in the courtroom, because even though, you know, I came face to face with this guy who did this to me, I actually, because of the trauma and it was dark, I never remembered his face. And I made a whole point about, I do not want to be in the same room as him. I can't, if I see him, I will go into the mother of panic attacks. So, you know, there was a lot of, I think there was like a 2-month application process, and you had to do all these assessments that you were vulnerable enough to be given this dispensation, which is never given, by the way. So I got it. And you're in this little room with a laptop, and you can listen in. And I think it just, you can see like the judge and the barristers, but you can't see him. And you literally, there's nothing you can do but sit there and listen. So I was just furiously writing down transcripts of everything. And that was just my way of like coping. But then, and somebody was asking me the question earlier of like, you know, how did you have time to write the book? I was like, it was basically written through these like journals and stuff. I just had to like reorder and kind of make sense of some of it. Yeah, you're kind of like just literally grasping at straws of anything that can make you feel like you're back in control. And it kind of goes back to your point as well at the beginning of, you know, coping mechanisms. Like, I need to feel in control. And in trauma, you're often not, you lose control, you're in panic attacks, you're in dissociations. So it was a bit of a grounding for me. But I'm not a diary taker either. So, you know, I bought these diaries and I was like, do I like start with daily diaries? So I just stuck to bullet points and then transcripts. But it was very empowering and actually very useful in the end.
It was useful, wasn't it? It wasn't quite as evidence or anything, but it was,
no,
you were able to refresh your memory.
Able to refresh my memory. So you give, like, when the crime happens, you have to give a statement to the guards, the guardie, and you give the statement to them. They handwrite it as you talk, so you have to talk slowly, and, you know, you're trying to grasp onto like memories, and you're just like blurting out stuff because you're just trying to be like, I think he had black hair, I think it was 3 a.m. you know, you're just like talking so fast. And memories come back after. So I was just writing everything down. So that helped to refresh my memory, because my victim, my witness statement, because in the eyes of the law, you're a witness, not a victim. There was information there, but there was a lot of stuff I'd forgotten. And trauma is a funny one. Like, it's just, there's stuff that's erased from my brain where I reread the notes and I'm like, oh yeah. Or some I still don't remember and have to ask Alison. And she's like, that happened. And I was like, really? And it's like, yeah, I mean, you wrote it. It's maddening.
One of the other interesting things that you were saying about the room, there was a whole hoo-ha around a screen that they were going to get for you.
Yeah. So that was like one of the toughest things to get. So basically, again, back to the point of, I didn't want to see this guy. And, you know, for a trial, like, relating to a sexual offence to happen in Ireland, the victim must give evidence. Even though you've given a full, you know, witness statement to the police that's written down, if you do not take the stand in that room in front of, I mean, they say 12 people, it's 30 people minimum. That was with COVID, because there's reporters, there's barristers, there's policemen, there's the 12 jury, there's the jury minder, there's the clerks. So there's like a room full of a lot of people. And I was like, I can't be in this room full of a lot of people. You know, at the time, I still struggle with public speaking, but like at the time I was like, oh my God, and trying to convince 12 complete strangers this was going to happen. And I was like, if I see this guy, I don't know how I'm going to react. And I just, it's too much. Like, I mean, I can't tell you the anxiety those 2 weeks, like every single day not knowing what was going to happen. But so there was a provision in some Irish Act, I can't remember the name now, that allows you to give evidence via video link. So I was like, perfect, we'll do that. And the guards had said, yep, no problem, we can arrange. So when it got to meeting with the barristers, I think it was like 2 months before the trial or 1 month before the trial, they were like, oh no, you can't use a video camera. Like, that's only for minors or, you know, people with a disability. I was like, okay, great. Well, that was not made clear to me. So went back to the Act. And there was another option, which was like, you can put a, so kind of like those screens behind you, you can put like a large screen so that you're shielded from the guy's view and vice versa. And I was like, okay, perfect. That sounds like what I want. You had to put in an application process. It's not automatically granted, to demonstrate that you are feeling vulnerable enough and that basically you having this screen is not going to hinder his right of a fair trial. Because let's not forget, he's the most important person in the room. So, you know, in the like assessment is basically you have to be interviewed by 5 guards. So mine was done on camera and they kind of ask you like to list all the reasons why you need it. Why are you vulnerable? Like, did he hit you? Is he an abusive partner? Blah, blah, blah. So like I remember giving all of the reasons and like by the end I was a weepy mess and I asked them to take a note of that as well. And I was like, this is me just talking about the idea of doing it, like there's no way. So the screen application was put in, didn't hear back for like weeks and weeks, and we were approaching the trial and I was like, I like can't go on the stand if this is not secured. Can we get this secured? And they were like, no, the decision will be made on the day of the trial, because again, you know, the judge has to be seen to be considering all of the advantages, and so you know, all of the guy's rights and my rights and balance them and be fair. And then the guards added, also, there's only one screen in the country. And like, and you should see the screen, by the way, like it's half of that size. It's like a little square. So like if I stand or move, oh, and he's allowed to stand to stretch his legs. So if he stands, he can see me. So it's like pointless, like a handkerchief. But we got it secured in the end, but it was just a whole rigmarole of like, you know, them trying to locate, and then they couldn't locate the screen on the day. They were like, oh, we don't know where it is, and she's due to go on the stand, and what do we do? And then they realized, if we put the screen up and, you know, she comes in, she's going to walk in front of him. So we need to change the running order that she comes in first and then he comes in, but he needs to come through back door. That won't work. So eventually they got me to sit next to behind the judge and kind of crouch and then let him in. Or no, sorry, they were gonna let him in and I had to like crab walk along the wall to go sit down, so undignified. And, you know, again, like shaking, crying, because you're about to like, you know, like I'm very comfortable talking about it now, but 2 years ago I wasn't. So it was just like a farce. And so after that was over, you're expected to go back in for the remainder of the trial so that the jury remember there's a victim involved. It's good for optics. And I pointed out to them, we've made this whole song and dance about getting the screen. It was fought against so hard. We barely got it by the skin of our teeth. And now you expect me to sit in the audience and I can just see his barrister jumping up and down being like, well, that's not fair. Like she, you know, she can be fine and mistrial. So when I pointed that out, they were like, oh, let me think about that. And then I got a call the next morning being like, yeah, on second thought, don't come in, bad idea. But can you get your sister or your cousin or somebody to come in your place so that the jury keeps in mind there's a victim here? But it was just like, I think, again, that's why the diaries were so important, of like, I could see all these mistakes being made. And I was like, if I hadn't called out that, like if I wasn't a lawyer, or I was, you know, didn't have the presence of mind and I could have not, that could have caused a mistrial. And there were loads of examples like that that I have peppered throughout the book. But
you do. It's hard not to conclude that things were really
bad. Yeah, I would say the system is rigged against survivors.
And that's one of the things that you've been tackling with the minister.
Yeah, the Minister of Justice, Helen McIntyre. Yeah, so after the trial, so basically when the trial was ongoing and I could see all these like shocking things happening, I was toying with the idea of going public about the story, and not really to tell my story because I'm not a very voyeuristic person, but to kind of get the word out that like our systems are screwed, like we need to burn it down and like start over again. But I didn't want to waive my anonymity, and that was like a big thing for me of like, once that's gone, you're the poster child for rape. And like that didn't sound too appealing at the time. And I was like, what'll it do to my career? What'll it do to my dating life? What'll it do to my personal life? My friends be weird? You know, will you be like wheeled out at every event of like, here's our trauma survivor? So I was hesitant about it. But what happened was, I was told I couldn't say anything publicly anyway until the sentence had been passed. And what happened was, when we got the conviction in December 2020, the judge decided, again, for fairness and balancing of the rights, that he needed another 2 months to decide what the sentence would be. To, you know, he basically, it looks bad if he or he or she comes up with the sentence then and there, because they haven't considered everything and they haven't considered mitigating factors. So there was another hearing in, I think it was February, but between that period, when I was not allowed to talk about what had happened, because I'd be waiving my right to anonymity, a lot of newspaper articles started coming out, because there's reporters in the rooms. Nobody tells you this. There are news reporters in the room, and the stories get published in The Independent, The Irish Times, like, you name it, they're published. They can't name you. But Ireland's a small country, and, you know, you hear of, oh, you know, woman 28 woke up with burglar on top of her, strangling her, and then did this. And I mean, they went into such graphic detail. And I started getting all these messages from people being like, oh my God, you poor thing, I had no idea. And, you know, people I hadn't spoken to in years, distant colleagues, they all knew it was me, because, you know, the story of the burglar made the rounds. And so all the texts that came in, like, they meant well, but, you know, there was a lot of pity in them. And, you know, or I read them that way because I was fuming at the time, rightly so. And so then I was like, right, well, I've got nothing left to lose now. And sorry, one more thing happened before I went public, which is, after all that rigmarole with the screen and not going into court and blah, 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 when it came to giving my victim impact statement, I could do it by video, and they forgot to turn off the massive screens in the building. So he saw my face, and I was like, the one thing I do not want is for him to see my face, because he doesn't know what I look like either. And at least I've got that protection of, if I ever run into him in the street, you know, he won't know. And so it, like, came up, and my cousins were in the room, and they were like, everybody saw it. Like, he knows what you look like now. So after that, I was like, well, screw this anyway. So I'm going public with the story. And I reached out to Una Mullally in the Irish Times, who was amazing and handled the story so well. And, you know, very much made it about the issues with the justice system, you know, but it was a full, like, two pager or something in the Sunday Times. So it got a lot of attention. The story went viral. And following that article, the Minister of Justice reached out and said, let's have a meeting, like, to talk about the improvements or whatever, which I think was kind of, you know, it was lovely of her to do, but I think it was kind of like, let's kill this. And I was like, OK, well, nobody's going to see the meeting. I probably won't be able to talk about what's said. So I'm going to write an open letter with the top seven issues in our criminal justice system. And I published that on The Times and a number of websites, the DRCC website, to kind of, you know, make sure somebody's accountable. And so, like, sure enough, you know, she's an amazing woman. Like, she's doing a job I would hate doing, because it's such a slow moving industry to change laws. I certainly would not have the patience for it, but, you know, she does and is working on that. So there's been a huge amount of work done with her, with the DPP, with the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, some projects I can't talk about, but, like, there's a lot happening, and it's really encouraging. That said, the most encouraging thing to me is these rooms where there's people, because you guys are the people that are going to get the change across the line. Like, if nobody talks about this, I can go, like, yapping on to, like, Helen McEntee all day, but she ain't gonna listen. Like, you need people to kind of back this and be interested and, you know, click into stories and, you know, like, amplify stories and, you know, make sure that everybody's heard, because I'm just one of thousands and thousands of stories. And, like, you know, one of the reasons I went public as well is, you know, he was not Irish, you know, his family's not here, so I had no repercussions, like, of running into his family in the supermarket, or my mates running into his mates, or whatever. Like, that part is gone for me. I don't need to worry about that. A lot of people don't have that advantage. And sometimes it's a family member or your boss or, you know, somebody in the community. So you can't come forward with it. So I feel very lucky that I can, and kind of want to push that further for those who can't.
Yeah. I think there will be questions here from the audience, so let's open it up to the floor.
Thanks, Sarah, for sharing and for advocating for change to the system. Sorry, what were the seven, you mentioned seven items that you would like to see changed?
I'll tell you, so I can't tell you all of them, but the number one, and it's actually one we haven't talked about today, and some people in this room may know, the issue around cancelling records. So in Ireland, any single time there's any sexual offence that's raised and, you know, brought to court, as part of the accused's right to hear all the evidence against him, the defence will seize the counselling records of the victim, and those records will be read by the entire defence team, the entire prosecution team, the judge, and the accused. This was not made clear to me when I started counselling, and I was going on a weekly basis for months and months before the guards rang and were like, by the way, can you give us the details of your therapist in the DRCC? And I was like, why? And they were like, because we have to seize the records. And I was like, hold the phone. Like, you know, that, like, when I talk about, like, the trial being traumatic, it's that, those parts as well. It's the whole system is just ludicrous. And so to add insult to injury, those records then, you know, will be used as evidence only against the victim. So if, which in my case they did, the records fully corroborate what you've said has happened, they will be disregarded after having been read by the defense, the accused, and so on. But if there's anything in there of like, oh, do you know, I'm having second doubts now, maybe I was wrong, or maybe I encouraged it, or I was drunk, or blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, like I had talked about like my dating life afterwards, and I was terrified that somebody would be like, well, she's talking about dating and she went on a date 2 months after, so she's a liar and she's fine. And, you know, if she was a good, you know, sexual assault victim, then she'd be, you know, asexual for the rest of her life. So that was like the number one, like, most horrifying thing. And it happens mainly to dissuade victims from taking the stand because they know they'll use your evidence against you. The other one was like the use of the screen, of just making that like automatic. And I also make the argument that, you know, if I had raped somebody and then was dragged in, or sorry, if I say was accused of having raped somebody, haven't done it, and dragged to court, I do not want to be sitting next to this person, seeing them spew stuff, because you're sitting like this close, which like the architect who designed that needs his head examined, definitely. Like, yeah. But I, and the reason they don't want to give you the screen is it makes him look guilty because there's a little handkerchief between you. And I was saying, well, if it's automatic for every case, then it's not. And also, surely it's like proper order. You know, like in the UK, defendant is here, victim is there. I think it's the same in France. They're much further away anyway. So that was the other one. There's a couple of others. So, you know, the release of the records for like the media, I was kind of making this the argument that that should be more controlled. Like there should be laws around it of, you know, I wish those newspapers had come to me first saying we want to run this story, because actually I'd have given them the best story ever. But instead they, you know, went ahead. Or, you know, there's been examples of people who, you know, it was reported on in the media and they give you the date and it's a tiny village outside of Cork. And everybody's like, I remember that police van that pulled up at 3 a.m. outside, whatever. So just those kind of things. There's a few more. There's another piece of legislation that is so outdated that allows the accused to cross-examine the victim. And I'm, again, making the point that, you know, the nature of any sexual offence is such that you just can't allow that to happen. It's not like I'm claiming that, like, you bowed out of a contract or you didn't pay your fees on blah. Like, this is so deep cutting and personal, and it, you know, it needs to be regulated. I also make the point that barristers need better training, because, like, I encourage you to read chapter 8, I think, or 7 of the book for some flamboyant behavior from the defense barrister. Just shocking stuff, and like trying to, you know, very clearly trying to win the case on a point of ego when it is so obvious what has happened, you know, the intentions behind it, and so on. So they were the 5 I can remember. There might have been 2 more, but yeah, we'll go with those.
Thank you.
There's.
Thank you. I feel my anger rising here, but in any event, just tell me about navigating through work, because at some point that you were going to go back into work, was that a whole nother, oh my God, what do they know? What do I tell them? How do they react? What do I, was that another?
Great question. It was so hard. And yeah, exactly. Because in work, you know, we want to show like a more polished version of ourselves. And, you know, if you're like a lawyer, you want to come into a room confident and like be able to do your job. And so, yeah, the first, you know, thought I had was, do people in work know? Because they knew about, you know, the burglar and so on, and that I'd been assaulted. I absolutely hate that term assault, because it could be like somebody shoved you in the Lewis, and it could be somebody raped you. There's like no, you know, it could be anything. So I kind of was worried of how people would react. And so sure enough, the people who did, there was a lot of, you know, like I remember a good few people, if I was walking down a corridor, they'd lock eyes with me in panic and like run the other way because they were terrified of like not knowing what to say. I get it. Did not make me feel good, but like I don't hold, I, you know, at the time I was angry, but I don't hold anger against those people. But certainly I think like work, it was, it just did not go well, like my re-entrance into the workplace. And, you know, I couldn't stand having people behind me. So I do that really weird thing in meeting rooms of like standing with my back against the wall, like a crazy person, and nobody knows why, or, you know, like being weird about handshakes, or, you know, getting triggered by stuff and just, you know, needing to exit a room quickly or whatever. And, you know, it wasn't handled very well by HR. And so a lot of people didn't know or didn't have the full facts, and it was just messy, let's put it that way. And so again, I feel like if people had better training around these things of how do we talk about it, how do we make sure the person feels heard, because every person is different, like somebody else might come in and not want to deal with this. But like I know two people in that office who came to me afterwards and were like, you know, I was raped and it was swept under the rug, and I, you know, told them, there was no hiding. So it is really difficult. And, you know, like we all have like, you know, kind of high powered jobs or whatever, and like that's great, but you have to remember there's a human factor there as well. And that can only make you a better worker, by the way, better manager, better team player, like better everything. If you're like just your authentic self and you're meeting people where they are and you're like strong enough, you know, to just be uncomfortable, that to me takes a lot of courage. And so like to me, the best thing anybody can say is what you said of, I feel vulnerable talking, I don't feel comfortable talking about this, but I'm still here and I want to. I find that so liberating because I'm like, well, I was uncomfortable, but now they've told me they're uncomfortable. So, okay, like we're both on the same page. So, you know, like let's just be awkward together and like figure out a solution. Yeah.
Thank you. Sarah, such an inspiring story. And I suppose one of the things you talked about was, you know, your anger with everything that went on. What do you think ultimately saved you? So I know obviously you fought back, there's yoga, there's I suppose the support of your family, but what ultimately do you think saved you?
Oh, that's a good question. I will say, like, yes, the yoga and the family, Alison. I wouldn't be here without that. But I was still, even, you know, like when I got through it, I was like, when I said got through it, I was functional around the time of the trial and afterwards. I could have kept living the rest of my life like that. But when I went public, and I don't know what I was expecting, but nothing could have prepared me for like that tsunami of comments, words of support, words of love, you know, affirmations, survivors coming and sharing their own stories. That was the most healing thing. Like I could get quite emotional talking about it. That was the most healing thing to me. And it just gave my life purpose. And so back to like the ashes of like, life is over. Like there's no point to this anymore. It's the end. And it was the end of that old life. The life I have now, I wouldn't trade for the world, which means I don't regret it happening. And it was a horrific 3 years. Like don't get me wrong, I wish it on nobody. But like I'm very, more than at peace, I'm very happy and fulfilled now, because I feel like I'm helping. And you know, even if it's just helping one other survivor or helping change laws, but actually the most important thing to me is connecting with other humans and like being vulnerable. I think we've forgotten or we're never taught how to be vulnerable, and that you can be a high-powered professional, whatever, a working mom, like every, and still be vulnerable. And that can be actually your greatest strength if you embrace it, and it takes time and a lot of trial and error, so like be nice to yourself. But yeah, that was probably what did it.
Thank you.
I'm going to take the last question unless there's anyone else. So my last question is, over the last few weeks since I've read your book and talked to you a few times, I'm going to confess to you a little bit of worship. I think you're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
But one of the things that sort of crossed my mind, do you know, I wonder if Sarah ever has a bad day, and you know, at the end of the day, feels bad for having snapped at her mummy for no reason, and you know that you can't blame the trauma for. And so just to sort of bring this all back to a personal level.
Yeah I love that question because yeah, like, you know, I'm here like preaching and stuff, I don't get it perfectly, and I certainly don't get it perfectly every day, And like, yeah, there's plenty of times where like, you know, stress builds up, or like, you know, before coming to this event, I was quite nervous, slightly snapped at my boyfriend. I have to go apologize later. But like, yeah, like we all have bad days. And like, it's like recognizing that as well, of like, you are only human. Like, you're going to get stuff wrong. And, you know, people trying to support a survivor, as I said before, you're going to get it wrong. And the survivor is also going to get it wrong. And it's about like being able to take a step back and just being kind to yourself and being like, yeah, I really, really screwed that up. But, you know, it's part of it. And like, I'm still learning. Like, I feel like if I rewrote Ash and Salt today, it would be quite a different book.
Yeah.
Like some parts, like, you know, the kind of like the assault and everything would be the same. But the like ever, like the last chapter on like healing and where I'm now would be quite different. And, you know, I think when I wrote it, I was kind of like, I've hit the perfect level now, I'm over, I'm healed. And, you know, then you discover like you're never going to stop healing. And that's a good thing. Like, you just get stronger and stronger and kind of more comfortable with it, I guess.
Actually, that's one of the things whenever I start reading it, I don't know why, but it's like, this only happened 3 years ago. We're like, that's not
long. It feels like I'm sure longer. It feels like longer, and then it also feels like a year ago, but it's like the, like basically since the Irish Times has been such a whirlwind, yeah. And COVID, time is just a weird one now, but yeah, it's mad.
Sorry, you've been an absolute delight to work with.
Likewise, yeah.
Still worshipping you slightly, but I think everybody would agree that it's brilliant that you're able to share that story with us. And now we are going to pass to having some wine, I think, and some canapes.
Everybody needs a drink.
An opportunity to talk amongst ourselves and to get to talk to you as well personally, I think. Can we give Sarah a
I've nothing to say. Yeah, but mine, Sarah, thank you. That was inspirational, as I was kind of hoping and I kind of half expected. And thank you for sharing everything. This, I can't believe how quickly that hour went. And I've been to a lot of, financial services events and payments, and an hour can be a long time. That was amazing. Thank you so much. Please, everybody, we'd love to join for a bit of some grub and some wine. So please join us. Thank you very much.